KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
Joe Biden and Donald Trump have clinched their party's nominations in the 2024 presidential election, but we still have 8 months to go. The election has been and will continue to be in the news constantly, but is the media getting it right?
This horse race has been the dominant way of talking about politics for so many decades that I think it's just fully entrenched. It's less in my mind about lazy journalism and more about a fundamental frame of how do we understand what this whole thing called politics actually is.
How should the media be covering such a heated race? Can you really present what each candidate says neutrally, or is there a better way to get at the truth?
People are very media savvy, and manipulating journalism is an art form that a lot of folks have been working on for a very long time.
I'm Matt Leon, and today on KYW News Radio In-Depth, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. We talk with Dr. Jeffrey Boehm, a media studies professor at Temple University, about how the press covers elections, why we might need to take a different approach to this one, and what voters actually want to hear.
So we are already in the midst of a presidential campaign. What do you think, in a perfect world, the public should expect and demand from the press as far as coverage of the campaign overall and the two nominees, Joe Biden and Donald Trump?
Sure. In a perfect world, I think in a perfect world, we should get political coverage and campaign coverage that leads with the concept of the public interest. The purpose of all of this, in my understanding, is to serve the needs of the citizenry. So the kind of journalism that we most need are the ones that give us the information, circulate the arguments, give us the opportunity to contribute to serious conversations about the problems the nation is facing, the solutions that the candidates propose. That's something quite distinct, I think, from so much journalism that is really pitching an entertainment product, trying to get us to watch, trying to sell our attention to advertisers, trying to speak to our emotions, our fears, our anger, our anxieties. That's a more of a disservice, I think, than slightly more sober kind of journalism that really privileges the public interest and public value, that is trying to make a contribution that will better the situation as opposed to perhaps play on our base emotions to drive us further apart.
Do you think we have gotten that in the past? And when I say the past, I mean in the last 50 years or so. Do you think that there were times that we really got it right?
I think it's always dangerous to be overly nostalgic. I think that every era has its problems, so I never want to idealize a previous moment in history. But I also think that for many years, particularly in broadcast news, there was a sense that this was a public service. You know, in an older environment when, let's say, the big three networks, particularly CBS and NBC, these were huge broadcast operations that had enormous audiences for television. They were making a fortune off of entertainment programming, but they also thought of their news divisions as a public service, a loss leader, if you will, that was not expected to make profit, but was expected to serve a kind of public democratic obligation. So certainly in an earlier era, and I would date this, you know, probably sort of early 1980s and earlier, there was just a greater sense that journalism in its broadcast form was a public service and not an entertainment commodity. That really starts to change in the 1990s, and we've seen a progressive movement away from that ideal of public service since then.
In the idea of public service, one of the things that I think a lot of times you hear people say from a high-minded standpoint, they should talk more about what the candidates' policies are, what they will do with X, Y, and Z. But it seems to me those are the articles and those are the segments that nobody seems to pay attention to, that don't get circulated. Should you keep talking about policy if people don't care, don't seem to care?
Right. And I think some people very much care. I think you're right that a lot of people don't care. I think that policy is often very obtuse It's hard to package serious discussions of policy in a 90-second broadcast story. Policy positions don't really boil down to easy slogans, quick sound bites, bumper stickers. One of the challenges of policy is that it's very difficult to predict forward as to what the issues that a presidential candidate or actually a president will be facing. One of the major things that our political leaders have to do is respond to current events, respond to the unanticipated. So when Donald Trump became president in 2016 or in that campaign, nobody was asking him, for example, what his policy was relative to public health, to the Center for Disease Control, right, and to medical science. And that ends up being, with the COVID pandemic, the single most critical thing that happens during his watch. You saw the same thing many years ago when George W. Bush was running for president back in the year 2000. I remember this quite vividly. He was asked about the concept of nation building. That is foreign policy. Would you use the resources of the United States to try to meddle with other countries' government and political arrangements? And he said, absolutely not. He said, I have no interest in nation building. Well, of course, then the terrorist attacks of September 11 happened, and the United States spends 20 years doing exactly that nation building in Afghanistan and Iraq. So on one hand, we can't ever predict what sort of the platform or policies are going to be that truly matter. I think that what matters more in the campaign is value systems. It's less about my policy on inflation would be XYZ, and more how do we articulate the problems that the nation is facing and what are the range of solutions that candidate X or Y would seriously consider? What sorts of people are they going to appoint? You know, we always lose focus with the president that the president is not a lone individual. The president runs the executive branch. The president appoints all of the cabinet secretaries. And that's where so much of the work of policy and governance actually happens. And I would love for us to spend more time thinking about that and a little less time thinking about sort of the individual character of the human being.
All right. So one of my big critiques of coverage of presidential election and election season is so much of it is framed in the horse race idea of who's up, who's down, who's gaining, who had a good day, who had a bad day. And I think it really does a disservice because there's so much on the line here and there's so much in play, and it just boils it down to up or down. And this isn't new. I feel like it is on steroids now, but there has always been a lot of this as long as I can remember. Is this just a result of laziness? Is it easy for a lot of journalists, specifically your Beltway types, to just kind of put this together and it's a way to have their quote-unquote finger on the pulse and not really have to dig into anything? Is it what people want? We talk about they don't want to talk policy. Do they want it distilled just to this simple, you know, Joe Biden had a good day, Donald Trump had a good day, whatever it is? Or is it a combo of all of this? How would you say, like, how did we get to the point where everything is just so dictated by that horse race angle?
You're right. That's a really excellent question. And you're right that this isn't new. I mean, you can go back to the early 1990s and find very smart people writing criticisms of journalism saying, this horse race focus, you know, horse race where it's really about a sporting competition. As you said, it's about each day who's up and who's down. Is it laziness? I don't know if it's really laziness per se. It might be convenience. Certainly, I think that the expectation of daily journalism. Certainly the folks that write opinion columns, you know, that's a real challenge. They have to come up with something new and interesting every single day, 5 days a week. And anyone who works in the news business or has worked in news knows that there are some days that are action-packed and some days where really nothing happens. But that need to tell a compelling story every single day pushes us away from sort of longer-term and contextual thinking and towards what happened today. And that frame of what happened today really lends itself to this horse race, because every single day we can say, were the Oscars good for Joe Biden? Were the, you know, is the new inflation report good for Donald Trump? So it is a matter of convenience that is driven, I think, by that 24-hour news cycle. There's a deeper point, though, that I'd love to make here, which is that this horse race point, as you're saying, has been the dominant way of talking about politics for so many decades that I think it's just fully entrenched. It's less, in my mind, about lazy journalism and more about a fundamental frame of how do we understand what this whole thing called politics actually is. It equates it with sports. I'm a sports fan. Go Birds, right? When we watch the Eagles, we want them to score more points. We want them to run good plays. We want them to get the leg up on the Cowboys. And next week, we'll see if they can do it to the Niners. That frame, one versus the other, with sort of incremental gain each day, who's scoring points, that's an easy way to think about it. And it's a way that I think this gets back to the point I was saying earlier, the sort of public service versus entertainment. It reduces it or turns it into a spectator sport that I can follow as a fan each day. And that drives us away maybe from a deeper understanding, certainly of governance. Like, I think the part that the horse race model really gets wrong is that this ultimately is not a competition to see who can get more votes. I mean, of course it is in one way, but that's simply for the right or the mandate to try to enact policy, to address problems, to propose solutions, and to try to guide the nation. And that's an ongoing daily grind that for a president happens for 4 years, right? Whereas the election, that's a few months of high stakes entertainment, perhaps just like an NFL football season is.
One of the things going along with horse race, and one of the things that in my opinion dictates this horse race coverage, is the almost fetishizing of the latest poll. When did polls become... Polls are useful. I'm not trying to trash polls because I know a lot of people do a lot of good faith work to try to put them together, and it's becoming increasingly more difficult to find people to take part. But I always kind of thought of them as a tool. Well, this is interesting. Now, a poll comes out and it drives the news cycle for 24 hours. And it doesn't drive from a, hey, let's dig into who was in this poll. What can it tell us? What are the crosstabs, you know, the different aspects of it? It is simply that Donald Trump now leads by 4 points, according to poll from X. This means disaster for Joe Biden. Number one, we're 8 months from the election. You and I could probably go back and find polls 8 months from the election that would tell a completely different story from what actually happened in history. Once again, I kind of come back to, why have they become, is it just convenience? Well, here's a talking point that I can use to just forward the discussion another day, because it doesn't seem to do the public service to just be looking at the scoreboard like that.
Yeah. And scoreboard's a really key point here. I mean, first of all, much respect to the good pollsters. I have very dear friends who do public opinion polling. It is incredibly hard work. And there are some very smart people working very hard to try to do this work. And it's valuable. But polls never have predictive power, right? No amount of polling can tell you what is going to happen when the election actually occurs. It's that whole coin flip concept where it's 50-50, but that doesn't tell you how a coin is going to land. So you're right, they can provide very valuable snapshots into the mood of the nation and to how certain demographics are trending, but they're not going to help us to really understand how this thing is going to play out. Scoreboards, I think, are really the key word because it fits. It's a big number in the sky. I think about gas prices. You know, we often think a lot about the price of gas, and I don't know how meaningful the price of gas actually is as an indicator of people's economic well-being, but it's a big number that's up there in the sky. You know, literally, you move down the street and you see these big numbers, and if they're going up, that has a feeling of anxiety. If they're going down, then maybe we're winning. The stock market is something similar. You know, to make sense of the stock market, you've got to look over many years, but each day you can see, is it in the red? Is it in the green? Are we looking good? Are we looking bad? And polls, I think, are the same way. There's an inherent complexity to this whole question of elections, even at, you know, the city council level all the way up to the presidential race. These are incredibly complicated, very high stakes. And as we try to fit that into, you know, daily breaking news, polls do give us a clear peg to hang our hats on each day that fits very much with this turning politics into something like fantasy football, where we want to know the stats. We want to know how the candidates performed today. We want to know each day how something is affecting their well-being. So polls provide maybe what the political scientists would call a heuristic, a shortcut to try to understand something that's very complex and can be read in a lot of different ways. Polls boil it down to something very clear and apparently, you know, with quantitative certainty.
One of the things that I find really distressing is Donald Trump is not your normal candidate. He was not your normal president. That's why a lot of people love him, right, wrong, or indifferent. But it seems to me that a lot of people that cover politics want him to fit into the box. So he does a lot of things, says a lot of things that are over the top, like saying, I want to be a dictator on day one. And there's a lot of other things like that. Once again, this is why a lot of people, his followers, like him, is because he says stuff like this. But do you think a good job is done presenting of what this rhetoric means and could mean if he were to get power again?
Yeah, I think this identifies, we're getting in the deep end of the pool here now, and this is an important waters to explore, right? For many, many years, the approach of journalism has been that this is a well-established process with clear rules of the game. I don't think we can keep covering politics in this day and age as if the rules of the game are universal and objective and well-established. I mean, as you're making this point, part of the appeal of Trump for his supporters is that he violates all of the rules of the game, that he's not playing the same game. And part of the question, I think, in this election is, what sort of game are we trying to play here? What really do we want a president or a government to actually be? So there are big, deep questions that are in play right now that maybe in an earlier era, there wasn't that sense of confusion, right? We didn't, the distance, if you will, between a Republican candidate and a Democratic candidate simply weren't that far. There's an old saying that in the United States, to use a football metaphor, that we play politics between the 40-yard lines, you know, whereas maybe a European parliamentary system, they might get out to the 20-yard line on either side, that historically our candidates and our parties have been pretty similar. And maybe that's a point of frustration for some. Whereas when you look at Trump or Biden, they're not just, you know, different parties. These are entirely different attitudes about what government is, what it should be, what a president ought to be, how the presidency should be run. And I do think I agree with you that journalism could do a much better job of approaching it in that regard, right? That's another weakness of the horse race, is in the horse race, you've got two very similar horses running down a clearly marked out lane, right? And they've got jockeys who look the same with bibs, with numbers, and it's the same stopwatch timing, both of them. Whereas here, you know, these two are so different, not just in attitude or character or even policy, but in fundamental attitudes towards things like democracy. And I think for journalism to be a true public service right now, it needs to be quite honest about what is at stake here.
And one of the things that I see is you see a lot of people, because I think a lot of journalists, and it comes from a good place, feel that they have to be neutral. They have to present things as neutral and let the people decide. But once again, you know, when the candidates were Bill Clinton and Bob Dole, okay, you know, you're different. What's the tax rate going to be? You know, how many people are going to be in the armed forces, stuff like that. You know, but this is fundamentally different. And it seems to me by presenting this stuff as neutral and not giving people the context of what it would mean and what could happen, you're not doing the job, because then, in my opinion, you just become a stenographer when you're just presenting what people say and not presenting any kind of context for it. No?
Yeah. Again, you're very insightful here. Do we assume that everybody agrees on the basic rules of the game and we're just trying to decide, you know, right or left? Is this a question of right or left where the journalist ought to present both sides? Or is this a question of right or wrong? Is there an understanding of what the United States is, what a democracy is, who we should be, or are those deeper questions on the table right now? I believe those deeper questions are at stake. You know, one of the things, back to polling, one of the things that really smart polling has uncovered is that we don't all agree that democracy is the right system. You know, for many, many years, that was the core assumption, is that everybody agreed that we want to live in a democracy and that the people's votes should count. And everybody still speaks that language. But when you really probe these questions, there's a certain percentage of society that truly does not believe in democracy, that would just as soon have an authoritarian government. There is a saying I've seen, you know, better Russian than Democrat. And anybody who grew up during the Cold War, those are that's some pretty intense language to say we would rather have a dictatorial autocratic system than one where the Democrats get to be in charge, right? That suggests that we don't all share the same fundamental assumptions about what kind of political system is correct. And that presents journalists with a fundamental quandary, right? Because for decades, as a great example, Bob Dole and Bill Clinton, you know, different kinds of policies, but again, maybe not even between the 40-yard lines, maybe between the 48-yard lines, right? So similar. And journalists themselves shared those basic assumptions about what the boundaries are, what the rules of the game are, what the goals here are. And I think that's the kind of conversation we need to be having, much more than how much does one particular demographic support one candidate or another. That's less important right now than implications of these two very different ideas of what government itself ought to be and how it should be used.
And I think another thing that happens when you take the approach of doing your damnedest to be neutral is bad faith actors take advantage of that. If you are simply just going to recite what a source tells you, what an insider tells you, and it is presented as a lie or, you know, something that is just markedly untrue, but you don't present the context of it because you feel like that's taking sides, well, the person that plays by the rules is always going to be the one that loses because the other person's telling what they want to hear.
That's right. There's a model in England called accountability journalism, where the purpose of it is not to give each side a platform to make their points, but rather to come from a perspective of, we believe in our system, we believe in democracy, and the questions we're asking you, the politician, is to what extent are you going to be accountable to your words and actions and committed to serving the public good? In this very complicated media environment we live in, people are very media savvy, and manipulating journalism is an art form that a lot of folks have been working on for a very long time. So that's also part of the journalists have to be quite aware and willing to confront efforts to undermine them and challenge their authority to try to help citizens to be engaged participants in a democratic system.
We need to take a break on KYW News Radio In Depth. We will have more with Dr. Jeffrey Boehm of Temple University's Klein College of Media and Communication in just a few moments. But right now, there's nothing quite like the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid when it comes to exhilarating efficiency. With hybrid technology and thrilling capability, these vehicles deliver an electrifying performance on every drive. This new year, discover for yourself what truly makes these hybrids special. Redefine your driving experience with Honda, KBB.com's best value brand of 2023. Contact your local Honda dealer today about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid. And now on KYW News Radio In Depth, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Boehm, professor in the Department of Media Studies and Production at Temple University's Klein College of Media and Communication. One of the things that jumps to mind for me is the age question in this election. Joe Biden's 81, he'll be 82 if he's reelected. That is old. And that is a legitimate concern going forward. Would he be able to serve out another 4-year term? You know, what if something catastrophically health-wise happens? I mean, all legitimate to be having with the leader of the free world. But a lot of times I feel like this is presented as if Donald Trump is not 77. As if, you know, if Nikki Haley was on the other side, then I get it. All the focus should be on Joe Biden from a question of this age standpoint. But it feels like all the fire, for the most part, in the mainstream press in the DC Beltway is directed towards Joe Biden and not kind of equally, when I think age for both candidates should be a significant talking point. No?
Yeah, I think that's one of the great mysteries here, how a difference of what, 3 years in age is being somehow made out to be this enormous gulf. No matter how you slice it, whoever wins this election is going to be in their 80s by the end of the term. And that's a real question. But it really isn't so much one of, is Joe Biden too old? I think what you have there in part is the sort of inside the beltway. We have to be objective. We know that we're reporting a lot of negative news about Trump, in part because there is so much negative news, right? The man is standing, is appearing before juries and judges and has something like, what, $450 million currently in money he's got to provide to move on with his legal appeals. There aren't equivalencies there, right? Joe Biden, whether one supports his policies or not, these are really different kinds of political actors. So perhaps this is an overcorrection on part of the Beltway because they don't want to be seen as taking sides. This great point you've already made. So what are the real critiques of Joe Biden here? I mean, maybe immigration policy is one we can look at, but yeah, age, the individual, how do we swipe at both sides? And I'm not sure that the job of the press is to go out of their way to find potential flaws with each of these people. I think the job of the press is to really try to investigate. I mean, and at a certain point, both of these men have been president, right? So we can compare records, we can compare outcomes. And I don't think there's as much of that going on now, which is another interesting point in that part of this horse race journalism is there's no memory. There's no memory of what happened 5 years ago or what the situation was 7 years ago. We start every day brand new, back to athletics. You know, a good sports team has to be able to shake off last week and tackle this week afresh. And that's sort of how journalists want to cover politics, as if the last decade hasn't happened at all. Whereas to me, that sort of historical context, what do we know is the record? What have both of these men done in the position of president? I would want to start there.
Yeah. And that's another thing. That's a great point you just made about the last decade. Not because another thing, it's amazing to me, is the politicians that voted to not accept the results of the 2020 election. And eventually you have the January 6th insurrection. It seems to me that is something that should never get memory hold. Like, to the point where I feel like it's almost a public service to provide, if you introduce a politician who objected to any state's results, say, this is so-and-so, the senator from Missouri, who, it should be noted, voted against accepting the results of a free and fair election. Like, once again, it comes back to that bad faith actor where if you almost start every day anew, then you don't provide the context that what this particular politician has done maybe has been really bad for the public good. And I feel like, once again, bad faith actors get rewarded in our political journalism circles because there's almost a repulsion to bringing that up or framing things correctly.
Right. And this gets back to, what are the rules of the game? Right. Was January 6th, as the Republican Party said, a legitimate political discourse? Right, that phrase, legitimate political discourse, is incredibly important here. What really, what are the boundaries? What is out of bounds? What is simply a violation of the system? And I am of the opinion that invading the Capitol to try to overturn an election is objectively a violation of the rules here, objectively a violation of the system as it is designed. And you're right, this gets back to the question of accountability, right? Accountability is backward looking. Accountability says yesterday or a week ago or 10 years ago, you did these things. Whereas horse race is very forward looking. It's what's going to happen in the next 24 hours. This is exciting. It's a lot about predicting the future as opposed to thinking carefully about the recent past. And that thinking carefully about the recent past is, I think, of much greater value right now than trying to imagine, is tomorrow going to be a good day or a bad day for one of these candidates?
One of the things that there's a lot of concern, you talk about whether we should be a democracy, and there's not universal agreement on that. And one of the things, it's almost like I feel like the Beltway press, there's a lack of self-awareness of what if Donald Trump were to act on his impulses in a second administration with really nothing holding him back, a lack of self-awareness that they would be in the crosshairs. They would be the ones that would, you know, fundamentally be hurt almost immediately, if not eliminated, you know, where their jobs didn't exist anymore. And it would seem to me that that would be kind of a bucket of cold water on, well, wait a minute, if I'm really going to look at this, I need to look at this, you know, like this could really happen. Almost a lack of imagination that something like that could happen when it absolutely could.
Yeah, imagination is such an important concept. Imagination is not the same thing as, you know, fantasy or like child's play, but imagination is the boundaries of what we can think of. Right. When we think about the future, when we think about democracy, what can we imagine might happen? And there is a limitation of imagination going on here. So when Donald Trump was president and he continuously yelled fake news, that's a true threat to a free press. And recognizing it as such, again, do we assume that the center will hold, that tradition will win out, that the way we've always done it? Scholars who study democracy make the very disturbing but important point that there's no guarantee that a democratic system remains a democratic system. There is, throughout history, there are countries who become more democratic, but there are also countries that become less democratic. So they, you'll hear that referred to as de-democratization or democratic backsliding, all sorts of measures to say, you know, really how free, how politically engaged are the people, how despotic are the leaders, how safe are minority populations, whether that's political minorities or ethnic minorities, and how free is the press? You know, there are organizations that rate freedom of the press. And the United States, despite our own mythology, we're kind of middle of the pack, actually. I was just looking at a rating the other day that put us 48th out of 170 nations. We want to believe that we have the freest press in the world. But when you actually look at the full range of factors that influence how free journalists really are, we're kind of middle of the heap. I'm not sure that's something to feel particularly proud of. And one thing that I think is really important to understand here, relatedly, and much respect to what you're doing, is local news, because democracy begins at home. And one of the unspoken crises that is happening in our country right now is local newspapers are failing across the board, that the business model of local newspapers with classified ads and sports sections and, you know, ads for the local department store, in the age of the internet, that business model has completely failed. And there's very little profit to be made in printing local newspapers. But where are the serious local journalists? Because democracy begins at home, right? Part of the nationalization of all of this, I like to think that the president ultimately is one of the least important people in terms of our daily lives, right? The president makes very important decisions, no doubt. But much of our daily life, what happens here on the streets of Philadelphia, I teach at Temple University, right? What happens on the campus of Temple, it's the City Council of Philadelphia, it's the state government of Pennsylvania that have tremendous influence there. And we overfixate and we're overly thinking about the two guys running for president to represent the entire nation. And we're entirely forgetting about things like the House of Representatives, the people that are in the federal government most assigned to represent us, or all the way down to the local level, to the folks that represent each of us in our state governments, whether we're in Jersey or Philly, right, whether that's New Jersey or Pennsylvania. Those people are incredibly important, and they get virtually no attention at all because we're so fixated on the latest poll about the presidential race or who said what following the Oscars, you know, the tweet and the Trump's Truth Social comment about Jimmy Kimmel in the middle of the Oscars. You know, that's what gets all the attention. But gosh, who's running for House of Representatives? Who's running for state government? Who's going to control the state government? Especially when you think about things like efforts to overturn the 2020 election, that the way our system is designed, that's a state by state decision. So if you have a state government that is hostile to democracy, that causes a lot of problems, regardless of what the national vote is. So when we think about 2020, very brave, and many of them were Republicans, right? This is a nonpartisan issue. Very brave people in Georgia, in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, standing up and saying, I am going to defend democracy, even if it means that my team is losing this game. I worry very deeply that if we overly focus on the presidential election, then we lose understanding of state government, where so much of the sort of structure of democracy actually takes place.
That's it for this episode of KYW News Radio In Depth, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. You can listen to the podcast free anytime on the Odyssey app, and you can find it wherever you listen to your favorite shows. I'm Matt Leon, and we'll have another episode out soon.